welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 288 of the podcast, and it is the 24th of September 2016 as I record this. So today I have an interview with Toby Neal, and we're talking about writing successful series, as well as Kindle worlds and using setting effectively, which is super exciting. And in publishing news this week, very pleased about this one in the UK. And I know if you remember back when Nook decided to give up on their international stores and they closed down their UK business, they gave their customers to Sainsbury's, which upset me a lot because Sainsbury's is a supermarket. It's where you go to buy food, not books. And so I was quite upset that they did that. But turns out that Sainsbury's have now decided to quit their ebook business and have given their customers to Kobo, where they should have gone in the first place. Now, I'm sure that there's been a massive attrition of Nook readers who have probably all moved over to Amazon because, you know, they were clearly shown that they weren't valued customers by Nook or Sainsbury's. But hopefully those of you who have gone to Kobo are happy there. And I feel like there is more right in the world now. So that's interesting. Also, two books for you this week that I think is really useful. First of all, Productivity for Creative People by Mark McGuinness. Mark has been on the show and will be back before Christmas. Mark is a creative coach and has helped me immeasurably over the years. He always helps me see things more clearly. And the book is free. And it is about how to get creative work done in an always on world, and really useful if you're struggling with productivity. You can get it on all the usual ebook stores, or get it at lateralaction.com/productivity. And as ever, there will be links in the show notes. So that's Productivity for Creative People by Mark McGuinness. And the other book is one of those, it might be considered dry books, but can potentially save you thousands or even millions if you end up with a breakout hit. It is The 9 Worst Provisions in Your Publishing Contract by David P. Vandegrift, a US attorney who specializes in author contracts and also runs the Passive Voice blog. And David, or Passive Guy, as he comments online as, is very smart and sees the worst of publishing contracts. Now, this book, it's pretty short. As I record this, it's free, or it's going to be a few dollars. But it basically covers life of copyright clauses, out of print, non-compete options, rights grab, agency clauses, and payments, as well as some other stuff. And basically, yes, if you have a literary agent, they are meant to help with all of this. But at the end of the day, often agents do want to get deals done so that they can make some money. And you also need to always look after your own business. And there are plenty of examples of authors suing their literary agents. So let's all be grown up about this and read enough information that we understand what we're signing. There's really no excuses. So I recommend this book, The 9 Worst Provisions in Your Publishing Contract by David P. Vandegrift. I also recommend Deal Breakers by Christine Catherine Rush, and that's she's updating that at the moment. There's been a whole series on her blog about publishing contracts at chriswrites.com. And also How Authors Sell Publishing Rights by Orna Ross and Helen Sedgwick. These are books that will help you expand your publishing empire but not get into trouble. And so I think these are really important, and again, links in the show notes. So on personal news, I am only 42,000 words into end of days, so only managed I think 10,000 words this week. It's gone very slowly, as I've got to the point where I've lost the plot, in inverted commas. This tends to happen to me because I get really enthusiastic at the beginning. I also know the end, but I'm in that kind of soggy middle. I only need, 25 30,000 more words. But this week I had to stop and lay it all out and replot it, or reverse outline, as I call it, so I can work out how to go forward. I'm now much clearer on where it needs to go. So that's good. But I also wanted to talk about, and this kind of ties into the productivity thing. I do tend to give myself way too much to do all the time. And in a couple of weeks' time, I'm speaking in Denver, and then I'm going on to Oregon to a writer's masterclass, and then we're going to Israel. So basically, I am away from my kind of usual routine for over a month. So, and I've got a ton of stuff to prepare for that. And so I was just thinking, the whole aim was to get the book to my editor before going to Denver, but I've decided to just stop and take the pressure off, because the book will be improved by my trip to Israel, because let's face it, end of days, there's a lot that's in Israel, including the climax of the book. So I'm going to wait, and that means moving my pre-order date until January, but that's okay, because I think it will make the book better. And it's far more important to me to write a book that my audience enjoy and that I'm proud of than hitting a self-imposed deadline and getting massively stressed. And my husband was like, "What are you doing? You're killing yourself right now. So stop it." And I was like, "Yeah, okay." So that is my plan, is to, I'm going to try and finish the draft before I go, but I will not be attempting to get it to an editor. I will take the draft away with me, have a think, go to Israel, add some more stuff to it, and then get it to my editor before Christmas. So that is the plan, the new plan. And it's always important to revisit our plans, and life is important, and living each day is important. So yeah. Okay, so right. Thanks as ever for your emails and tweets. I always love getting them. You can email me at joanna@thecreativepen.com or tweet me at @thecreativepen. So TW Ian says, "Thanks for the podcast. I came across it 18 months ago and have worked my way through the back episodes. Some of the more recent shows are more relevant to those who've been in the book business for some time, but listening back, it's great to hear how you started. Although you're so far ahead of me now, it's amazing to think in those earlier episodes, you were also just starting out. Gives me the confidence to realize that if I put in the effort, keep on learning, keep trying, continue writing, there's no reason why I can't be making a living from my writing in 5 years' time." And I wanted to share that email, thanks TW, because first of all, I always find it amazing when people listen to 280 plus back episodes. That's just amazing. So thank you to everyone who's listened to every single show I've ever done. And also, yes, I started the podcast in 2009, which was 2 years before my first novel even came out. I had a couple of nonfiction at that point. I had, when I started the podcast, I think I just got on Twitter. I had a very small email list. Like my whole life was very, very different. I still worked in my day job. I didn't do these introductions for the first couple of years. So yeah, it's really interesting how things have changed. And another good reason to hopefully encourage everybody, it just takes time and effort over time. I mean, like podcasting, for example, so many people start a podcast and expect to suddenly, make money from it in the first 6 months. I didn't earn any money from the podcast until 2014? So I've been doing it for 5 years before I was making any money. And even then, and I'm really super happy with the Patreon support and Kobo sponsorship, and I'll be doing some other kind of ads for my own courses, but still, if you look at the amount of time podcasting takes, there's no way you can most people can earn enough to justify the time. But part of the reason I do this is, as you know, to enthuse you and to sort of share the journey and to learn from people and keep my own journey moving. So yeah, exciting times. So thanks, TW. And Rebecca also said, "I just spent the summer listening to the back episodes while crocheting doilies to sell on Etsy," which I thought was cool. Okay, some other tweets. Katie Coffrin, my cat is seriously annoyed that I'm trying to edit while listening to the podcast, sent me a lovely cat picture. Matt Weiss says, love the long intros, listening while I make some quesadillas for dinner. Yum. Jennifer Eremiva, listening to the podcast on a cloudy day in Moscow as I tidy my study. Here's the view. Beautiful, stunning architecture with a cloudy sky. And I have not been to Russia, so I definitely fancy Moscow at some point. Erica Lindquist, doing the print layout on my 26th book while listening to the show, is driving me nuts. Yeah, I must say, I pay someone to do print layout. I couldn't stand that stuff. Just, I did it for my first couple of books and they were so bad and so amateur. I now pay a professional for formatting my print books. Nick Warren says, spent the weekend recovering from carpal tunnel operation. Oh no, Nick, you definitely need to get into dictation, I think. And Alison Morton says, listening to the show on PR, spent the afternoon smartening up my contact pages and have done a photo gallery. And Alison made me feel really pathetic because I listened to, you know, I obviously did the interview with Janet and I'm sitting there taking all these notes going, I need to do this and that and the other and this. And of course, I haven't done any of it. So if you have taken action on a podcast and I haven't, it makes me feel super guilty. So that's awesome. And lots more, but I'll just pick one more. Jules says, took a tour of Stonehenge and Bath, which is where I live. Listened to your lovely podcast on the bus and sent a picture of Stonehenge, which is cool. So yeah, thanks to everyone for the emails and tweets with what you're doing while listening to the show. I love to hear from you. I love the interaction we have. So yeah, tweet me at The Creative Pen. Email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. Right, so we are switching the sponsorship up a little, as I mentioned, because the Patreon has got to a really great place, which again, I'm really super grateful to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. We are moving into a year when Kobo will be our main professional sponsor. So our main corporate sponsor will be Kobo, and the Patreon supporters, you get your own show once a month, and then the other shows I'm gonna do for my own courses. So because these are the things that keep everything running. So okay, so today's show is sponsored by my own How to Write a Novel course, From Idea to Finished Manuscript. So is it your dream to write a novel? Are you unclear on the process? Are you suffering from self-doubt as to whether your writing is good enough? Perhaps you've already written a book and it's just not hitting the right notes and you want to go back to the basics. Or maybe you write non-fiction and you're ready to try writing fiction. So if you've answered yes to any of these questions, then this course might be for you. I've now written 12 novels as JF Penn, hitting the New York Times, USA Today and Amazon bestseller lists. I've sold over 500,000 books in 74 countries and 5 languages. Now I'm sharing my process with you in this multimedia course. But don't worry, it won't be overwhelming, because I've gone with the iceberg approach, covering what you need to know in order to get that book written, rather than trying to cover everything in the exhaustive world that is the writing craft. So if you're interested, check out more details at thecreativepen.com/write-novel. And one student, Lee, says, thank you so much for putting the course together. I sincerely believe this has been the breakthrough that I needed to start writing without procrastination or excuses. It has been a real breakthrough for me. Check it out at thecreativepen.com/write-novel. Okay, so as ever, this type of sponsorship helps pay for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon, especially new patrons, Amy Maroney, Katie Forrest, Peter DeHaan, and Kate Harrison. And yeah, I really do appreciate the Patreon support, like the tweets and emails. It demonstrates you enjoy the show, want it to continue, and you can support the show with even just a couple of dollars a month, half a coffee a month, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I put out last week, I think, for September, and I will be doing early in October. So if you are a Patreon supporter, please enter your questions into the form. You know where that is. And I will be recording that before I go to Denver. And you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get on with the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Toby Neal. Welcome, Toby.
Hi, I'm so happy to be speaking with you and seeing you sort of in person.
Yes, very cool. Just a little introduction. Toby is an award-winning USA Today best-selling author of mysteries, contemporary romance, YA and nonfiction. She's also a mental health therapist, a career that has informed the depth and complexity of the characters in her stories, which is super cool. So let's start by tell us a little bit about you and your writing background and tell us a bit more.
Well, I'm one of those writers who always wanted to be a writer, but then was told that I needed to sort of have a real job. And
oh, that one.
Yeah. So I did go ahead and get a real job, which was I'm a clinical social worker, which in the United States is a master's level therapist, but it's a third year master's. So it's one step down from a psychologist, and I am currently in private practice doing mental health therapy one day a week, but I never expected my writing to take over my career and replace it. Mm. I began writing more seriously when I was 40, and my children were in high school, and I began to see the light at the end of the tunnel and that it was time to fulfill my dreams before they sort of expired. So I actually got started about 10, 11 years ago, fully diving in.
Wow. So you still love your day job as such, even though your day job is more writing, but the one day a week you still love what you do.
Absolutely. You know, it took so much to get all of that education. I was a mom going to college. So it took me 12 years to get all my degrees and then another 2 years for licensure. And it was a lot to just because I don't have to anymore. That was not, enough. And what's great about therapy is that it's working closely with people in their deepest need, and it informs my writing, it inspires me, and it keeps me in touch with the real world where real people live. And so I felt like even though I don't have to do it anymore, it enriches my writing, and it's a good chance to like actually put on clothes and leave the house with makeup on.
Yeah.
Whoops. I mean, I made it sound like I write in the nude, but that's not what I'm saying.
In your pajamas. But no, that's really interesting. Yeah. So because you're in like a clinical field, do you have two separate names, two separate brands? Do you keep your writing very separate to your therapist life?
You know, that's something I really struggled with early on, and I almost did a pen name. And then I went with my integrity, which is one of my personal core values, which is that if I can't stand behind my name and my writing and my professional life, then I don't want to be inauthentic in that way. So I'm going to go ahead and keep both. And I do have both. And I do have clients who Google me, and then go, "Oh, you're a writer." And then I'm like, "Yeah, are you okay with that? I'm not going to write about you, you know?" Mm. So that has come up, but not as often as you'd think.
No, well, that's what I was thinking. You know, maybe people would be like, "Oh, well, I recognize myself," even though it clearly wasn't them. They might come up with an issue.
That's always a risk. That's always a risk. But I'm in a good position right now. Even if that were to happen, I feel like I could weather it. So
yeah. Well, I think that's really interesting. And then just on I've got loads of questions for you, but I'm really interested in your therapist side because I did psychology. So it's fascinating. But one of the things like I obsess about with my fiction, and like Joanna Penn is like happy, happy. And then JF Penn, I have like my shadow side.
Yes.
How do you know, you're living in happy Hawaii, and we'll come back to that. And you know, you're all sunny. And how do you integrate your shadow side into your writing? And is that something you deal with clients? And then you tackle yourself?
That is such a wonderful question. And I feel like there's no clear answer. Writing is a way that we all try to understand ourselves better through the characters. My first book was definitely inspired by my work. Blood Orchids is the story and basically my best-selling series. the overarching character arc of it is a woman who experiences childhood sexual abuse, and then she's a cop, and then she has these different cases come up, bringing up her issues. And what I wanted to show through the course of the books, not just one story, but the course, is what it takes for a woman to recover from that kind of trauma and abuse. And this absolutely relates to my background. Not that I'm a survivor, but that I worked with clients who were. And that's where people have come to expect a level of authenticity and real experience in my books. And that's that gritty side of Hawaii, which is something that I've always been, you know, I'm a third generation resident here. And yes, I look like I'm straight from Ireland, but I actually am the third generation of my family to live and grow up in Hawaii. And that duality of paradise and darkness is just a theme in my work. And it's something that I'm fascinated with. I think we don't always get to choose our themes. They choose us.
Mm. Oh, that's really interesting. Have you seen Top of the Lake?
No.
Oh, mm-mm. Well, anyone who's it, well, Top of the Lake is set in New Zealand, set in a place called Paradise in New Zealand. And it's exactly what you're saying, because New Zealand's all like, oh my God, it's amazing. Yeah. And it's like really, it's a very dark series. So that's another example. And I think this is always true. You know, you think somewhere is always just going to be a paradise. And then we're human. Like humans are never all like happy and it's all great. But let's talk about Hawaii. So you live on Maui, which I've never been there, so I'm totally gonna come over at some point. So how does the location impact your writing? You've talked a bit about that, but you know, what are your tips for owning a location?
Right, that's such an interesting thing, because when I was trying to get started, I had a proposal for the series in the first book, and I was seeking representation. This was in 2010, when things were just sort of starting to really melt down with the publishing world. And a lot of my rejections were based on it's too niche. And I was so frustrated with that, because that wasn't my experience. I felt like there was a giant backlog of readers interested in this market, in this particular place, and in these kinds of themes. At the time, there was only two kind of writers that I found writing Hawaii mysteries. One was Jill Marie Landis, and then another guy named Chip Hughes. They're both still around, both still writing. And I thought, you know what? When my agent couldn't sell the series, in part because of that, but the other part was she retired. And I was like, oh no, what am I going to do? And at that point I was like, you know what, I'm going to self-publish. And that was the best decision I ever made, honestly. And what you see now, if you type Hawaii mystery, you will be mind blown how the huge numbers. And I feel like I was actually a part of breaking open that market into a subgenre where it's an actual subgenre of its own, with hundreds and hundreds of books and different authors. So what I encourage people to do is write about a place that they're passionate about. Take readers there. I mean, like, look at Louise Penny, you know, and Three Pines, you know, like, we want to know everything about Three Pines and we love it and we're never going to go there, you know. So you can milk that vein of gold a long, long way. If you, a couple of things I do that is unique is that I find local experts. This also saves me time as an indie. As you know, book production and speed is critical to success. But I also want to write well-researched, authentic books, which is what is associated with my name and brand now. And so how I do that is I find an expert who knows all about, say, Bonehook number 10, for instance, is all about reef conservation. So I came up with a plot that has to do with the delicate Hawaiian reefs and what's happening with overfishing and, runoff pollution and things like that. And I found this incredible young woman who is a former Department of Land and Natural Resources agent. So she investigated fish poaching and things like that. And then she was also an environmental biologist. And she became my consultant. We went out, we went out kayaking on the reef together. She talked to me about all the fishing. She read the manuscript. I interviewed her in depth. I pounded out the manuscript. I gave it to her. It didn't slow down my process at all, but it gave it that unique flavor and touch. So if you're going to write anything regional, mm-hmm. you can really save time and then also do great PR. So then I took photos of our outings into these protected areas. I wrote a blog post about her. She, of course, blasted all her friends and family. And now I've got this wonderful connection with all these new people that I wouldn't have known otherwise. Mm. So I repeat that process with each of the late crime series that requires it. So
yeah, that's fantastic. I do a lot of research too. And yeah, kayaking on the reef. I've got to write a reef book, I think. That must be something I should do rather than like gritty London. But no, one of the questions that people often have about writing where you're setting the book in a real place mm-hmm. is, you know, can you use like the name of a shop that's mm-hmm. really real, or, you know, mm-hmm. have a body found in a certain wharf mm-hmm. that might offend the fishermen, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with using real places in your books?
You know, I actually use the body discovery in the crime scene as a way to highlight my personal take on the story. Mm. For instance, I mentioned Bone Hook. There's a little tiny atoll off the coast of Maui called Molokini. And it's a little, you know, sunken, half moon shaped, very famous island. People go snorkeling there all the time. So I made that my body dump. And I started the book in 90 feet of water off of that little atoll. And then what I was able to do is draw attention to the battle over resources in that area, because exactly half of the atoll is protected and the other half isn't. Uh-huh. And fishermen come and fish. And of course, you know,
don't know where the boundary is.
Yeah, they don't. And I also am careful not to take a side in my books, only to present the issues and use the scenario of the books to talk about the issues. So for instance, I'm very sympathetic to the situation with fishing and and the demand for local fish, and then our fishermen trying to make a living. And I present that very, I feel, sympathetically, as well as the concern about protecting our populations. I did the same thing with Shattered Palms, which is set on top of Haleakala in a protected cloud forest with our native birds, which are also going extinct, and many people don't know that. And I grew up here and hardly knew about it. But it's avian malaria at lower elevations has decimated the native birds, and they can only live above 5,000 feet in the islands. So that puts them on the very tops of the mountains. And continued deforestation, you know. So anyway, what do I have? I have poachers. I have a dead body in the preserve, and now I can create a scenario that then I can discuss the issues as the investigation unfolds. So that's my suggestion is, you know, don't take a side. Use your central plot to tease out the issues of the area. And like, there's so many easy ways to do that. All those team meetings where they discuss, you know, well, who would have a motive here, you know, and what have you. Mystery does lend itself to that a little more than some other genres, I would say.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I love using real places. I think mm-hmm. actually it makes it more believable, and it, you know, it's easier to create that fictive dream as such. You know, I'm always really proud when I can get it right in a place I haven't been, although I like doing all my travel research, obviously. But let's talk about your main series, the mm-hmm. Lay Crime series, because mm-hmm. you've written 12 books now. You might have mm-hmm. written more since the last time I looked at your profile. but 12 books, and I'm just writing book 9 in my Arcane series, and I know that it can feel a little bit tired. And then you get an email from a reader going, when's the next book out, you know, in the series? Right. I love this series. And then it's like, right. I really have to carry on this series. So what are your tips for creating a series that can go on for a long time, and also about keeping your own interest? I guess you've mentioned a bit about theme, but what are some other things?
I wrote a pretty detailed blog post about that, and I submitted a link to you for readers to share who want to go into it deeper. But for me, I absolutely have to be engaged with the subplot of the main series, which is again my character's development. And I absolutely adored the Libby Hawker interview you did, because that brought that book, Take Off Your Pants, into my life, which crystallized things that I was already doing, but sort of by accident. I had happened upon this, and now, oh my gosh, there's a process that I can follow step by step, and it's absolutely on target. So that actually pertains to a long series. Mm-hmm. And what, like I explained, I was trying to show this process of recovery. And for my heroine, her process of recovery was her work, number one. Mm. Therapy is actually showed quite a bit in the books, and I have a very well-rounded psychologist character who brings in that more formal treatment aspect, and then the love of a good man. So I have a romantic subplot that's super powerful, and I would say that's actually what the readers keep coming back for. It's like, what's going to happen next with that romantic subplot? Once I basically reach the end of that arc, which is in book number 12, I really have, I'm not going to say I'm not going to do anymore, but yeah, it's completed, and it's how to keep it fresh. In my blog post, I talk about ways that I did that for me, which was I had to change up the subplot. I brought in a new stalker that went on for like 3 books. Then I brought in the love interest. Her love interest, Stevens, developed an alcohol problem. And that went on for 3 books. Like, how are we going to resolve that? And then, are they ever going to get to the wedding? And that was a couple, you know, like, so basically, as we complete each of these subplot milestones, we needed to find more momentum for the next book. I couldn't keep doing it. Like, I won't mention names, but certain mystery series, I've just stopped reading because the characters don't evolve and the stories are static circles in a row. And that's not something I want to do as a writer. It bores me. And I can't keep writing if I'm bored. So for me, the key is in the subplots and getting the subplots to extend and complete. And then the other thing is playing with points of view. So people are continually surprised when they pick up my next book. Who is going to tell this tale? Am I going to see it in first person, third person? You know, and in my final book, I actually told the story from 9 points of view, which was
George R. R. Martin.
I don't recommend that. I don't. I was blowing my own head with that because I was trying, again, in mystery, you can't repeat the information. You have to keep moving the plot forward in every character's mind. And that is a tremendous task when you're doing that many points of view. So kudos to anybody who tries that, and it's intense.
No, that's great. Well, it sounds like you keep challenging yourself, and that point of view is great. And I did a book in my series from Jake's point of view, and now I know that he will also be the next one, because I'm coming to New Orleans and I want to write a book there, and so I'm going to have him do that one. And it's just like, it's quite cool when you think about the different characters. And so that's interesting. One thing I did want to ask you is, how many books does it take? Because, you know, it used to be, or maybe it never was, but the myth was you write a book and then you make $1 million and then you can resign and live happily ever after. And then when I was writing the Arcane books, I really noticed at 3, I was making, you know, back in the day, it was more than $100 a month. You know, it actually kind of ticked up into something that was worth mentioning. So how long did it take for you, and what do you recommend? How patient should authors be?
Oh, that's again, your questions are so good. So for my series, it started getting off the ground at 3. But I was utilizing the tools that so many people have talked about, you know, a free special on the first one, you know, and things like that. So there's nothing original I really have to say about that. But now I believe it's 5. So I started to launch my next series is a romance series. And even with my established platform, the romances are very different from what I've done. They're set in other places. They're kind of a sweet, hot new adult, which
sweet
again,
and
you
hot.
Know, yeah, they're sweet and hot. So, well, you can figure out what that is. And they're just so not like my other, I mean, they have this sort of emotion driven intensity, which is what people associate with my work, but they're completely not like the lay series in that way. And I have struggled and struggled with them. I've changed the covers three different times. And then I'm like, you know what? It's just a numbers game. Mm. I have to have at least five of these books, and I've only got three right now, and three doesn't cut it anymore. Three isn't. And I believe particularly with romance, and this is sort of my instinct, both as a reader of romance and a psychology background person, is that romance readers basically fall in love with their character, that the characters with the author's writing, and they're not willing to commit until you've committed to their genre. Mm. And that's my theory, is that you prove your commitment by doing at least five books, and then you can maybe earn their trust and their buy-in to your series. So maybe that flies in the face of, oh, there's so many millions of romance books free. I know I won't pick up even a free one if there isn't more, going to be more in case I fall in love with this author. So that's my theory about that. I hope there's something useful in there. It might be different for other genres, but I think in the current saturated market, you got to commit to doing five books before you're going to see much happen.
I think it must be true of any voracious reader. And so I'm a voracious thriller reader. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, and I hate picking up a book and loving it and finding there's only one book. And it's like, so what?
Yes.
You know, it doesn't even have to be a series. They can be standalone, but if they're not in the same kind of genre or feel, you know, I'll be really, really annoyed. So, and also the international thriller writers did a survey that said, I think a reader has to read 3.7 books by an author approximately, so let's say four, before they remember the author's name.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really good information.
Exactly. Yeah. Because then you become, because who remembers the title of books? Like most of the time you're like, oh, I've just read the latest Lee Child. You don't remember the book titles, you remember the name of the author mainly.
Right.
So I
right.
think that's true in any genre. So I think that's really valuable. So you mentioned you've mentioned PR earlier, and of course you mentioned the perma free there. You know, what are your other sort of recommendations on marketing a series in particular, especially when you put out, say, book 12? Are you advertising the first book in the series? How are you getting people through that series?
Well, I am doing the perma-free, and that has been terrific to periodically kind of blast that and draw in new readers, but then keeping it going. But when I do a new book, this is my trick. I put the previous one, the one right before it, on sale for 99 cents. Mm. And then I have the new book either available for pre-order or on the market. And ideally, if I'm getting a BookBub for, say, number 11 for 99 cents, then I'm going to basically be able to sell number 12. And then they're going to be like, oh, and where's more? Oh, the first one is free. And then they go get that. And next thing you know, they're thoroughly hooked into the whole series. So that's my tip in launching later books in the series, is when you have a new one, put the previous one on sale, and try and get good visibility on that 99 cent. And, you know, I don't do it for a long time. Mm-hmm. I do it for like 5 days. I am sort of a believer in pricing for quality. So my price point is $4.99, and, I'm not really going to put out books that are super cheap and leave them that way, except for my entry books. So that takes some sort of holding the line, and people feel differently about it. So,
yeah, now I do $4.99 for full length, and $2.99 for novellas.
Yeah.
So, and in the UK that translates as £2.99.
Right.
Which is, you know, can be, people are like, oh, well, whatever. But actually what's so funny, Britain is now, it's after America, as in it's, you know, now all the traditional publishers are doing 99p deals, like the indies did a few years ago. It's really quite funny. But let's talk about Kindle Worlds, because you have a Kindle Worlds for your Lay Crime series, which is cool because it definitely makes me think that they are taking you seriously, like Amazon's going, you know, we want more books in this series. So can you, for anyone who doesn't know, what is Kindle Worlds and why is it a good thing and maybe not such a good thing?
Well, I just want to mention that I did a pretty detailed sort of survey related piece for our ally, you know, podcast, and there's a link there, which I interviewed many different people who wrote for Kindle Worlds. But let me, so I want to put that link out and you can take a really good balanced look at the pros and cons if people want to know more. But in a nutshell, Amazon decided to capture some cash off of fan fiction. So, and being the innovative company they were, they came up with a way of licensing that. And if you type in Kindle Worlds and go to the main site, you'll see there's TV shows, there's comic books, there's best-selling series. The series part came about because, partly because of my sales, but also because I had an opportunity to, this was interesting, you know, this quality that you have to have for success is to, if you see an opportunity, you jump on it. And I was approached by one of the Amazon editors in charge of the Kindle Worlds to write for someone else's Kindle World. And he asked me, and I was so excited to be approached by Amazon. And I was like, so you're offering me a Kindle World? And he was like, let me get back to you on that. Let me take a look at your numbers and let me find out who you are. And, you know, like basically he was looking for high selling indie writers. And so I ended up sort of selling him on me. anyway, what it's turned out to be is a blast. I work really closely with my authors, and in the bigger, longer piece you can read is that one of the downsides is maybe you think you're going to get to know Hugh Howey really well by writing for his world. And lo and behold, you know, he's sailing the world right now and not going to hold your hand through the process. So you may or may not have much help or support from the main author. I choose to do a lot of support and help and a really organized PR campaign every 6 months for the Kindle World books. So what it is Amazon has licensed with me to use these characters in this world in other works. And I make a small percentage on that. And the writers make a small percentage. I have two kinds of writers writing in Kindle Worlds. And this is what I see in general. First time newbies who are true fan fiction people who just want to write about the characters they love and maybe have a first book out. And maybe they're starting to build their platform and get a feel for what self-publishing is and all of that. And they love it. And it's a good experience because their books sell, you know, they will sell. And then the other kind is an author with a backlist. And maybe the backlist is compatible with my work or my readers. I believe in this so much. I've done two Kindle World books for other worlds. One is for Russell Blake's action adventure world, and one is for Emily Kimmelman's also action adventure female protagonist. And both of those have served to bring those readers over to my books. So that's a really powerful motivator to write for Kindle Worlds, is to bring these eyes of these dedicated readers to your work and your backlist.
Yeah. And it's funny because, I mean, I had a look at some of the books in your Kindle Worlds, and what the biggest thing that strikes me as a downside, but perhaps you don't see it as such, is that you don't have any control over the covers. You don't have any control over the quality of the writing. And yet it's associated with your brand. So, I mean, given that you can't say no to people either, like you literally have no control, do you?
Yeah.
So how do you deal with that?
Oh, well, how I deal with that is by making it worth the author's while to associate with me personally. And that's really why I do a lot more involvement with my authors than other writers, because I don't want really low quality works being associated with my world and my name. So I offer a basically, hey, come on in, be a part of our Facebook group. We have beta, I offer them beta readers who are, you know, love the light crime and will correct them and give them input. The covers is a little tricky because I actually have branded covers that are done by a, and this is a tricky thing, they're done by a high-end designer who owns the copyrighted look. So I actually cannot have my covers look like my Kindle World covers because she owns that look. And so that's how mine ended up sort of hodgepodgey. But if you look at Russell Blake's, he owns his covers. And so he was able to have all the his Kindle World books all kind of look like his, you know? So for me, it has been a matter of, hey, I'm going to help promote your book. And in return, you're going to have some accountability with me about the quality of the aforementioned book. I can't obviously read them all. It's gotten, I've got 40, there's like going on 50 books in my world. I try to read them all once they're out. And then I try to get them all into the Facebook group and associating with each other and cross promoting and reading each other's manuscripts so that the quality will come up. And we, it has worked. It has worked. Our, for a relatively smaller Kindle World author compared to, you know, Melissa Foster and some of these other really big names, we have consistently really high reviews and solid, strong sales. I've paid back my, my advance. We're making, we're all making money. We're all really stoked. So that's, extra work, but it has really, I feel, paid off. So that's how I've handled that issue.
Which is great. And one, I mean, one of the things that's annoying is that it's still not open to authors outside the US. And I mean, this is annoying. Well, it makes me wonder whether how successful Amazon are thinking it is, because why haven't they opened it to, I mean, because it, why shouldn't it really just be part of KDP? Like, you know, and I know there's some programs that they try, and then if they're not massive successes, they just don't roll them out. So what, what's your feeling on that? And also, how can non-US authors get into it if they want to?
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting theory. I have to, because I do know that the some of the staff turned over in the Kindle world in terms of who's running the program. But from our end, we have asked that multiple times. Why isn't this international? This is a really big problem. And then the other thing we've asked is, why aren't these Kindle World novellas eligible for KDP Select? It seems like
a no-brainer.
And yet they aren't. So what the original editor that I worked with basically told me, yes, I believe in those things. Yes, I want to see those things happen. Yes, I'm trying to get that to happen. And it never happened. So I don't know the answer to that. I do know that my Kindle world is profitable. I know that that's also a lot of extra work, and a lot of the main authors may not be willing
to do that,
to make that kind of commitment. So then the other thing is, what do you do if you're a foreign author? So I have several from Canada writing in my world, and there's these third party kind of distributors that are available. I thought about including links, but I would prefer for you to find your own. The my authors have been very, very happy. For a small percentage, these third party distributors will upload your book and handle all that and send you your payouts and all of that. So that is certainly available to foreign authors through a third party distributor. And hopefully Amazon will roll that out soon. I don't know.
Yeah.
They don't tell us.
Yeah. And it's funny. Well, I mean, you know, we've all got to remember that what's profitable for us as an individual author is not what Amazon might consider profitable on a bigger scale. But this is why I've held back, because I would love to write in Blake Crouch's Wayward Pines. Like, I really wanted to do that. And I would probably write in Jet as well. And and my friend David Wood, I think, is going to be in there as well with one of his series. And then, because it's not available, I've made the mistake before. Like, I jumped into a third-party distributor with ACX before they rolled out to the UK. And then a year later, they rolled out to the UK. And of course, I now don't get that income because that goes through someone else.
So I was like, pull it back.
No, you can't pull it back because, it's signed for 8 years or whatever. And I was just like, do you know what? I always jump too soon. And with Kindle Worlds, I was like, nope, I'm going to wait because they're bound to roll it out. And then it's just still not happened. But that's definitely something I think many people are interested in. So you can take it to your rep and say, there are more authors who want to write in this.
Definitely. That was what, by joining Ally, and I really love that organization. I know you talk about them a lot. Mm. I got to really get a flavor of that and of the bigger picture of what foreign authors are looking for and struggling with. Mm. So, yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Amazon hasn't told us, but they did keep reassuring us. Yes, we're going to do that. Yes, we're going to do that. And that's what,
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're running out of time swiftly, but I did want to ask you, just kind of coming full circle back on the therapist thing, because, mm-hmm. You're writing all these different books. You've talked about, how speed is important in getting books out. And, we've heard stories of some indie authors giving up altogether. I mean, not just indies, traditionally mm-hmm. published authors too. Having to learn about marketing, there's so much that we have to do. So mm-hmm. what are your tips for sort of mentally staying the distance and doing this for a long-term career? How can authors sustain this for the long term?
Wow. Well, I hit my first wall that I never thought I would have any writer's block, but mm-hmm. I guess it was partly of exhaustion. In 4 years, I had written 20 books and I sort of hit a wall in November. And I also had just finished a book that I actually thought was my best book. Mm-hmm. It's Red Rain. And it was number 11 in my series. And I didn't know that this trap was out there. And again, as you grow and evolve, that's my challenge to other writers is don't ever get in a rut. Keep evolving, keep pushing yourself, keep trying new things, try other genres, try other perspectives. That's what's going to keep you writing and loving it. Not everything is going to make money. Not everything is going to be a hit. And maybe a lot of it won't, but it's the joy of the creative thing. As I was sitting there talking to my husband recently about, the balancing act between the creativity of being a writer and then the sheer just business of marketing and, mm-hmm. and selling books. And it is, it turns out I have a knack. My grandfather was a tremendously successful self-made man. And I was like, I think I just inherited that and I didn't know it. It turns out I have a knack, but if you don't, and I kind of love the challenge, mm. like, ooh, I can't figure out how to get this to go. Like my romances, I try this, I try that. And then I keep coming at it. As long as I feel like the writing is strong and it's something that I love and it's something I can stand behind. So for me, that's really critical, that aspect of integrity and of the creative risk taking. Mm. So I feel like risk taking is important. So back to my writer's block.
Yeah.
I wrote a blog post about that too. But what I ended up having to do was what I call going analog. Mm. So we're all so digital and I had to go analog. I had to turn everything off. I had to turn my computer off. I had to turn my radio off in my car. I had to turn off music in my headphones, audiobooks, anything. And I had to just sit with the silence of my own head and my own thoughts and wait there. And I felt like a miner, in front of the blank wall at the end of your mining shaft, and it's hot and sweaty and dark and you don't know where you are. And you're just sitting there with your little tiny chisel going, mm-hmm. am I ever going to find the gold again? Am I ever going to get out of here? And I was there for 4 months writing by hand, everything turned off. It was actually Kindle World that got me loose. I had told Emily Kimmelman, who's now become my co-authoring partner, that I would do a novella for her Kindle World. I had a deadline and I was like, I'm blocked. I've got to do this and it's got to be done by X time for her launch because it was a launch book. And then I had this little tiny idea. two girls on a road trip that goes badly wrong. Kind of a Thelma and Louise with guns and bad Mexican police. And it was like, it was such an awful little idea. It was so embarrassing. I wanted it to be like after Red Rain, I wanted to be like, oh, this writer's got chops, you know, and how do I top myself? And it was actually like, you know what? I have an idea. It's like a balloon on a string. I'm just going to kind of have, and I'm going to grab it and I'm going to tie it down and I'm going to go with it. And I'm going to be humble and I'm going to say, hey, I got an idea. I'm at least writing again. And then that has led to the co-authoring because again, what co-authoring has brought to me the most is, and I'm co-authoring with Emily, we're actually doing a six book romance thriller series, apocalyptic, love in the time of pandemic.
Awesome.
It is awesome. I have to say, we're both just on fire. It's fabulous. And so again, if you're blocked, stuck, if you run out of gas, you know, take the time to sit in that for a while and let that inform you about whatever it's about in your life. And then, when you get an idea, don't kill it. You know, even if it's a humble little, sad little idea. And, you know, my novella ended up being super fun and I felt came out very well. And it was just such a pleasure to be writing again that then now I am, you know, well on my way and producing again. So, but I'm not counting myself out to run into that again, because there's these secret hidden minds and they're all in our mind. This is the therapist part of me that says, it's all about your cognitions and your beliefs. And there was a part of me that didn't believe that once I had done my best work, there wasn't anywhere else to go.
Oh, yeah.
It's a cognition. It's a belief. Mm. And I didn't even know I had that until I ran into it. Mm. And so that's why I say, you know, I know you've had several people talk about never have writer's block again. I just honestly don't think that I feel like I have every possible tool to never get writer's block again, but writer's block comes from the mind and we don't always know what's in our mind and it can stumble us. So, you know, be prepared to just let it be what it is for a while.
Yeah. And I think that the emptiness that comes after you've given everything to a book, like I wouldn't personally call that block. I just call that, I'm now empty. I now need some time to fill myself up again in order that I can empty myself into the next book. Because if you do give everything that you've got to your book, then it is the best thing you could have written at that point. Right. But that doesn't mean you can't write another best thing you've ever written, like another time. So I know what you mean. It's all in your head. But I also think that so many people who are blocked are empty and they literally haven't filled their creative well, or they've just given it all away. So then they need to kind of start that process again. So no, I think that's a really good take. Right. So where can people find you and your books online?
Well, thanks to this podcast, I am out of KDP Select and available on all platforms. And I definitely give you the credit for that. I did very well in KDP Select. I was, I think a 5-time top author with the bonuses and everything. And I just couldn't imagine that I could make more money and it could be better. But since I finally took the chance and I busted out of there, and if you're going to do it, if you're going to do it, wait till you have a good batch of books. Like, don't just, you know, like bust out with a whole bunch of books and then you've kind of got clout and then do your special and relaunch yourself on all of the other platforms. So you can find me on any of the stores right now. You could get the first 3 books in my series free by getting Blood Orchids is perma-free. The second one, you signed up for my newsletter and you get that one. It's an award-winning book. And then the third one happens to be on sale right now. So Late Crime, you could get the first 3 free if you were interested. But I totally feel like all platforms is the way to go for me now. But if I were starting out, I might still try KDP Select for the first 3 books and sort of build some momentum before I went that way.
Go wide.
That's another thought.
Yeah, no, brilliant. And what's your website so people know?
TobyNeil.net.
Fantastic. And I will link to all those blog posts in the show notes. So thanks again for your time, Toby. That was great.
Oh, it was wonderful to see you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.